Rosinas on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast.
Welcome to the Criminal Compliance Podcast. My name is Christian Rosinus, and we have a new exciting episode today. We're talking about the current climate for investigations, and in particular, the increased focus on personal liability for executives. And I have a dear friend here on the podcast who helps me navigate through. It's Jonathan Armstrong, one of my favorite UK colleagues. We are working a long time with each other, and it's so great to have you here, Jonathan.
Ja, es tut mir leid, aber mein Deutsch ist sehr schlecht. But vielen Dank für die Einladung.
It's fantastic to have you here on board. Maybe you can shortly introduce yourself to our listeners. What are you doing? Where are you coming from?
Yeah, sure. I'm a partner in Punter Southall Law. That's a UK-based law firm, but we do work internationally. I'm also an adjunct professor at Fordham Law School. And I'm a director at a business called Elevate, which helps train directors to be fit for the boardroom.
So you have a lot of experience in advising multinational companies across Europe on risk management and compliance, and also the academic skills, so to say, to transport it in a proper way to the executives, to help them understand and navigate through any issues that may arise.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And I've been doing this, I guess, for about 30 years. So I should be good at it by now.
You are good at it. I know that. So maybe let's start with this. Like, what is the current climate like in investigation?
I think the climate's really challenging. I think it's probably the most difficult time since I started doing this 30 years ago, because I think there are different pressures from all over the place. I mean, first of all, if you look at the area of maybe whistleblowers and in investigations, well, clearly GDPR has changed that world. I'm involved in some investigations at the moment, and we get very aggressive subject access requests from those who are the subject of investigations. And the law has made that easier in the UK, cases like Guriev and Gurieva, for example. Secondly, I think there is easier access to lawyers for individuals who are the suspects of investigations, particularly, or whistleblowers. I think that's the case, especially in the US, where lawyers probably come free. The political climate, thirdly, is more challenging. There are no home games. Regulators are crossing borders with more frequency. So even if you're close to your home regulator, another regulator from overseas might step in. Fourthly, I think the pandemic's had a big effect. I think it's changed loyalties. There's something that we call quiet quitting. So a lot of employees are present, but they really want to get out. So that loyalty has gone. Fifthly, I think there's probably some generational factors. There's all sorts of surveys. LRN's done one, for example, that says that Gen Z are less likely to be loyal. They're less silent. They speak up. And that's likely to add to conflicts, particularly in marches against DEI rules, for example, that the Trump administration seems to be leading. Number six, I'd say whistleblower laws across Europe have changed. The culture's definitely changed. There's more readiness to speak up. You know, if you contrast France, for example, 10 years ago, where whistleblowing was anonymous denunciations, and then Sapandeurs has sort of allowed that, and then the whistleblowing directives changed that again. I think there's a change of public opinion, a change of regulator approach, this almost reverse burden of proof in things like the UK's failure to prevent fraud legislation that's coming in this year and the Bribery Act. And then there's three last factors, I'd say. There are attacks on legal privilege throughout, which makes the investigation difficult. So starting with the AkzoNobel case in the EU, but also moves to join in lawyers as suspects in France and Italy. I think that makes investigations more challenging. And if we look at other jurisdictions like Russia and China, they've made life harder for investigators. I think there are challenges to the integrity of the investigations, again, because individuals are lawyering up more quickly. And so we've seen, for example, the SFO in the UK lose a number of cases that have been brought as a result of internal investigations that weren't done properly. And then I guess the last thing is that mistakes are big news. It used to be relatively rare that corporate scandals were covered on the business pages, let alone the front pages of newspapers. But obviously, social media makes all of that easier, and there's more pressure on journalists to produce more stories. So, as a result, if you're VW and you have one scandal, it's very easy for a journalist who has to write six stories a day or blog six stories a day to just keep writing about VW every day because that's one of their six stories done. So I think we're under more spotlight whenever we do investigations as well as a result.
I guess that's a view we also have here in Germany. We see the same phenomena, the worldwide development in this connect direction. You mentioned the whistleblowers. We have had a couple of whistleblower cases also in our practice last year. And we think indeed people speak up more and they also use data privacy or data protection law for their purposes. And you mentioned data protection law or privacy law is being used in investigations by subjects of investigations, but also by whistleblowers. So maybe you can outline a bit more in detail what this means in practice and how to handle such a case like this.
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is whistleblowers are more ready to speak up, even if they are wrong. So, to give you a ridiculous example, a British former comedian, Russell Brand, just this morning retweeted a rumor that JFK was shot by a 1970s British comedy actress. It's a story that is absolutely absurd, but one that he's prepared to repeat. And that's an exaggeration, but you do see that with whistleblowers. Some of them have bad motives. China, for example, if you lose a contract, then there's a temptation to whistleblower against the winner. But often there are innocent mistakes. I've done more engagement with whistleblowers than ever before recently because sometimes it's worth chatting to the whistleblower w once you're some way through an investigation. And sometimes there's no factual foundation for what they are saying. Because we've encouraged people to whistleblow more, and because conspiracy theories have hit mainstream, sometimes those two trends are combining. But subjects of investigations are definitely using subject access rights under GDPR almost as a running commentary into the investigation. Tell me more about the investigation. How far have you got? Who's saying bad things about me? Who's involved in various decisions? I want all of the names. And oftentimes, the requests are wider than the GDPR subject access request, but that doesn't seem to stop people. And often they're asking for new documents to be created just to answer their own curiosity or questions. And again, GDPR doesn't require that. So quite often you're having to forensically look at these requests, which I think in the main are designed to slow an investigation down. And if you think about it, if you're an employee that's facing dismissal for wrongdoing, if you can delay the investigation by 4 months, then you get another 4 months' pay because we usually suspend people on full pay. So they've very little to lose, particularly when lawyers can sometimes come free in this environment. So I think this is becoming more of a concern. Some of us made representations to the European Commission back in 2012, I think, to say that this was the likely result of some of the GDPR provisions. We weren't listened to then, and it's a shame because I think that business and society as a whole is reaping the rewards of that legislation.
What do you think is the best solution for this? What is the practical advice you would give clients to handle these types of cases?
Well,
What if?
I would say this, wouldn't I? But privilege is very important. I think the days in which organizations, or most organizations, can conduct an internal investigation only using internal resources are limited. I think that I would say this. I know I've got a vested interest, but people have to think about going external more quickly, because then privilege may be a defense to subject access requests, for example. You've got to look at forensically at subject access requests when they come in, work out what is and is not in scope of the rules, and obviously think carefully about the documents that you're generating. You know, whenever there's a corporate crisis, people often speculate, add theories, and often that speculation can be wrong and it can be unhelpful, particularly if it sees the light of day. So there's all sorts of training around careful communications as well, and people only, you know, copying the people who need to know, being careful about the communications they have, etc., etc. Because email is the perpetual witness to bad things, but also it can be a witness to what people think are bad things, and they might not be.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's a shared experience. We have to deal with this. This is the legal situation. As you know, the privilege situation in Europe, in particular Germany, is different to the UK privilege. So it's a quite different concept in continental Europe and US or UK. So you mentioned that privilege is under pressure. What cases do you have in mind in this context?
I think, first of all, it starts with the European Commission and AxonerBel effectively not being prepared to recognize the privilege of in-house lawyers. Yeah. I think it expands into trends in other jurisdictions. You know, Italy, for example, I know that there have been cases where privilege is undermined by just saying, well, the lawyers must have been in on it as well. But it goes down into the very, very mundane. You know, just yesterday, I had a letter in a case where the individual who's involved in the investigation, who's made a subject access request, said, you can't rely on privilege for your client's US general counsel. Mm-hmm. Now, that isn't a correct statement of the law in the UK, but as I say, even at the individual level, they're trying to erode privilege or get behind it. And the commission, I think, maybe did everybody a disservice by trying this campaign against privilege originally, particularly in-house privilege. I think you're absolutely right. It's extremely complex, the situation on privilege,
yeah,
across the EU, let alone across the world. I can remember, probably got one on my shelves, you know, at Eversheds, we published a book on it, mm-hmm. maybe 15 years ago.
And I think it dramatically changed to then.
It has. and even the work of creating that book was, you know, it's not a big book, but the work involved in creating the book was considerable. And as you say, it's definitely changed since then. But there are solid principles that are behind privilege, and we have to make sure that we construct our investigations in such a way that we give ourselves the best chance of asserting privilege, even though that's challenging.
So that's a very good point. And having in mind the threatening of lawyers, what impact do you think the developments in the US have? The Trump administration quite rapidly changing, or at least addressing things to law firms, which are quite irritating from my perspective. So what do you think will be the outcome of this?
I think it's really hard to say. I mean, I think the whole question of compliance is that often the events of today are viewed in the rearview mirror, by which I mean that if we're looking at a corruption episode today, even if the FCPA isn't being applied today, for example, in 7 years' time, there'll be likely a new president. It might be President Melania. It might not be. but it will be that administration that will likely be investigating the events of today. So it's really hard to rely on things like relaxations now, because nearly always, you see, when there's regime change, there's a toughening. We've seen that in the UK. You know, we had a very lax administration when it came to things like COVID contracts, and we've now got an administration that's looking into the corruption of those COVID contracts. It's in the news again in the UK today. So, what will the Trump administration do in terms of lasting change? We don't know. We do know that lawyers are under threat in the US, which has traditionally been, in some respects, a place of safety. You know, I'm on the New York State Bar Association response force. It's very hard for us to decide what to do. Previously, our group has reached out in Afghanistan, who are under threat, in Poland, who are under threat, in Ukraine, are under threat, but and supported them almost from a position of safety. But there's a political threat on lawyers emerging from the US now, just on the basis, in some cases, of the cases that they have taken. And that must be wrong. If you believe that there's a principle that everybody is entitled to fair representation, then we shouldn't really be criticizing lawyers for taking cases where they're simply trying to do the best for their client.
That's true. So there will be another threat on investigations from this area or perspective.
Correct, because often people don't approach an investigation with a balanced mind. And that's a key thing for an investigator. You have got to approach it with neutrality.
So just to round this up a bit, as we're heading to the end, which consequences do you think that also executives are personally held more liable than in the past? So what would this change in the regulatory landscape or landscape have as an impact in future or future investigations?
I think that's a really, really good question as well. And the whole personal liability question is definitely something that's on the rise. And it's on the rise both from prosecutors looking at innovative ways to prosecute individuals. You know, we've seen cases in the data breach area like Joe Sullivan, like Carlos Abarca, like the Tim Brown investigation, where individuals are becoming, you know, more in the frame for events. We've seen that in things like misstatements, like the Bonnesen case in Sweden. And we've also seen politicians think that that's part of the answer. If you look at things like the DORA regime, NIS2, EUAI Act, they all are looking at personal liability for the wrongs of corporations. And again, there's a lot of care needed from executives, not just those at board level, but the level below as well, in terms of looking at things like D&O policy, doing proper due diligence before they take roles, looking at their own LinkedIn profiles, which we've seen feature in cases like Abarca, where the individual says, well, really, who could have managed that situation? And the regulator says, well, if anybody, you could, judging by what you say on LinkedIn about your skills. So we have to be more honest, I think, if we're executives in an organization, about recognizing our strengths and weaknesses. But we also have to them as well. You know, I was looking at a UK listed entity, for example, a large UK listed entity. It's got eight non-executive directors. For that organization is technology, AI risk. It's got nobody on the board with those skills. It's got four accountants, one banker, and three strategy people. Now, you have to look at the composition of boards like that. Are they properly responding to the risks that the business faces? And if they're not, they have to make their board more diverse, not only in terms like of ethnic origin and gender balance, which are important, but also in terms of diversity of skills as a result. And if they don't, then it's likely that we'll see many more prosecutions of individuals for the failures of their corporations.
That's a very good point, taking into consideration also the individual skills and responsibilities is very important in this context. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for this fantastic interview. I think we have learned a lot, and it was fantastic to have you here. It's always great to have your deep knowledge about these things and this long-standing experience with that. Great to have you here. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Dear listeners, if you have any questions to Jonathan, I will link his contact details in the show notes so you can directly get in touch with him. If you have questions you want to ask me, please feel free to contact us at info@rosinus-on-air.com. Again, info@rosinus-on-air.com. Thank you very much and see you next time.
Rosinus on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast. The podcast only provides a general overview of legal issues and, of course, does not replace legal advice on specific issues in individual cases. If you have any questions, please contact a trusted lawyer or, of course, feel free to get in touch with us. www.rosinusonair.com or at www.rosinuspartner.com.